This is the Revitalize My Church podcast, created to help churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. This episode is hosted by the Executive Director of Assist Church Expansion, Nathan Bryant, and his ministry colleague, Bart Blair.
Welcome to the 37th episode of the Revitalize My Church podcast. My name is Bart Blair, and I am joined by the Executive Director of Assist Church Expansion, Mr. Nathan Bryant. Hello, Nathan.
Hi, Bart.
Are you doing well on this fine day?
It's just after Christmas. Doing very well. Very relaxed. Probably too relaxed.
Yeah, too relaxed. Well, we are headed into a new ministry year, 2026. This is the first episode that you and I are recording together for 2026. And you have any thoughts on 2025 and how 2025 went for you?
2025 was I guess with most years, some really amazing things happened. And then there were some really hard things that we had to manage that aren't quite through yet. So, but the Lord has shown up in some ways that I did not anticipate, which is always true. God is God and he's actually at work. So I'm always, and sometimes I'm always surprised. Oh, God is doing stuff here. So, but no, I think the 2025 was a good year. God is good despite me, as I say. So,
yes, sure. Thank you for that reminder that God is God, just in case those of you who are listening to this podcast have forgotten, God is God. And yes, he was sovereign last year. He'll be sovereign again this year as well.
And then he's active. Like oftentimes we think he's not interested or not involved, but he's so active and dynamic in our lives, in the lives around us, and in, of course, growing his church, which he said he was going to build. So.
Yes, absolutely. Well, for those of you who have tuned into this episode, and maybe this is your first one, we appreciate you tuning in. And hopefully this will help kickstart some things for you as a church leader, as a ministry leader in 2026. We've been producing this podcast since the summer of 2024. And our goal is to help churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. It's not about making small churches into big churches. It's about helping churches that need to revision, revitalize, or restart. Find footing and find healthy systems and processes that will help them do that. Now, as you just said, Nathan, you know, Jesus said he was going to build the church. And I would say, you know, to the degree that it depends on us, we should just position ourselves to learn and to do the best things and the right things that we know how. I would say if I look back on 2025, I invested a lot more energy into just learning from other people who are walking in the same space that we are in coaching churches through revitalization and replanting, restarting. And so it was a great year for me. I learned a ton and I'm excited about being able to, you know, apply some of the things that I've been learning into the context of some of the relationships that we have with churches and also continue to bring some of those things here onto this podcast. I met some new people. We've got some new guests coming up here in the upcoming months. So I'll just casually remind our listeners and viewers that if they haven't yet subscribed, wherever they listen to their favorite podcasts, make sure that you do that so you don't miss any of our future episodes. We've got some good ones coming up here. Today, Nathan and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about failure, because we're pretty good at it. We've done a few things that haven't gone so great. We've done a few things that the Lord has blessed, and we're excited about those things. But the title of this episode, I've called it Five Common Reasons That Church Revitalization Efforts Fail. And I don't know that 7, 8, 9 years ago when you and I started working in ministry in this space together, I don't know that we would have been able to readily identify the reasons that many church revitalization efforts fail. But I think as we've walked alongside churches, we've seen some of the errors and the omissions and the roadblocks and some of the hiccups that happen along the way. And I was just out for a walk a couple of weeks ago and I was just sort of thinking through these things and I thought, I'm just going to make a list and we'll talk about them in a podcast episode and maybe we can set some churches up for avoiding some of these reasons. that Lord church revitalization efforts fail. So I'm just going to, you know, we've got five different points that we're going to hit on here. I think all are sort of equal in terms of their threat to a healthy church. And I'll start with the first one. And that is when a church is preparing to go through a revitalization or a vision renewal, I'm simply going to state it as overestimated readiness. They think they're more ready than they really are for the change that's needed. What would you comment on that, Nathan, in terms of your observations about churches and their overestimated readiness for revitalization?
I think they're thinking the change is going to be relative to the change that we're going to be asking, or a new pastor or a new leader, new vision coming in would be asking, are not always in sync. And so they're thinking change is, oh, we're going to get a new leader. Or that's not always getting a new leader, but most of the time it is getting a new leader. We're going to start growing and instantly, and we'll keep everything exactly the same, but things are going to start happening that never happened before in their minds. So, and they're thinking, well, we're going to see some change, but I think it's more, it's not tactical, like in terms of how they actually think change is going to happen. I don't know what they think the change is going to be for most of these people. When I talk to them, they're like, oh yeah, we're ready for change. We'll do whatever it takes. And then the guy wants to change the color of the back wall or take a painting off the wall. They're losing their minds. It's right. Like, we're ready for change. You can't even take a picture off the wall. Are we serious? So yes, I think, yeah. And also I would say sometimes that you have the core leaders who are ready for the change, you know, and really want to see and know the sacrifice that's going to take to do it. But the people themselves aren't ready and they haven't been prepped to think about and process what that would look like and buy in to the change that needs to take place that's moving forward. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the notes that I jotted down were, you know, their hearts are saying, yes, we're ready for this.
Yeah.
Their heads are not quite ready to follow their heart. Right. And the head sort of gets in the way of it. And part of it is that I think they're unclear about how much change is actually going to be required. They're looking for a silver bullet, a couple of quick little things that they can implement, and we can quickly lower our average age from 70 to 35. Like that's
or 25.
We just make a couple of changes here. I think a lot of times, and this is where you and I start in our revitalization process, is we start with the cultural changes that need to happen inside the church versus the actual practical changes. So a lot of times the churches want to race to what do we need to do? And we always start with the question, who do we need to be? And so I think there's a failure sometimes in not identifying some of the cultural and the social barriers that may exist between the congregation and its own culture and the culture they're trying to reach. I think that sometimes there's, and you kind of hit on this with the removing the picture from the wall. There's an underestimation of all the things that are near and dear to the existing congregants. Like we think we know what the big deals are going to be, but then we start tinkering with small things and we realize they were a really big deal. Here's a little story. Speaking of pictures on the wall, one of the churches that we're working with, I will not name it. One of the churches we've been working with for a while, there was this old, not amazing painting of Jesus on a wall in the basement of the building.
Okay.
Wasn't awesome. Wasn't amazing. It was fine, but it looked dated and it didn't, you know, it just didn't look awesome. And they had to do some plumbing work and some asbestos removal from their basement. And
okay.
The pastor took that painting off the wall in the basement when they were doing that. And he hid it in the back corner of the basement. He didn't throw it away, but he hid it. He put it where he didn't think anyone would find it. And he said it was gone for several months. And then one day he's walking through, he goes down the stairs, he turns the corner, and lo and behold,
there it is.
Jesus is down his way back onto the wall. He's like, I have no idea who found it or who hung it back up. And it wasn't a big deal, but for somebody, that picture being on that spot on that wall was actually a big deal. A big deal enough that they went and rooted around and found the picture and put it back on the wall. So yes, those things do happen, and they can sometimes create some grief for the pastors that are trying to lead that change.
Yeah. And also I think there's so much distinction. Like a lot of times people have done something for a certain way for so long that they confuse or they bring together a practice to theology. So they think that, oh, if we change this, we're going to be liberal. We're going to be going against the Bible or whatever, when it has nothing to do with the Bible. It has to do with culture, the things that you're looking to change. And so that becomes a real bugaboo for some people in their mind. They've been taught or have an ideology in their mind that if we do this or that, we're no longer honoring Jesus with how we do this, when the Bible doesn't actually say anything about the things that they're actually talking about change. Now, there are things, of course, in the Bible that we shouldn't do, for sure. But lots of times those things are not the things that are being argued about in the church. It's just that it's a cultural expression of doing church that they have been part of for many, even generations. And if you're wanting to make some shifts to a different cultural expression to reach different kinds of people, then they have a really big problem. They're saying, oh, well, now you're being unbiblical, and has nothing to do with the Bible. It has mostly to do with culture. And right. They can't separate theology from culture. And it's really interesting to navigate that issue. I think it's a big one for lots of people.
Yeah. I mean, there are things like, you know, pews versus chairs. Pews are more biblical than chairs. I don't know how.
Oh, obviously.
But they are.
Paul wrote about them extensively.
Yeah.
Pews.
Yeah. Yeah. That's in like 11th Corinthians or something like that, right? I don't
exactly.
know what the book is. Anyway, so as I put down the bullet points that we're going to talk about today, Nathan, I've identified some of these causes of failure in a revitalization effort. And I've put a little bullet point here as a potential solution or a way of overcoming this. And the first one here is actually to evaluate your church's readiness through a health assessment and a readiness assessment. Now, we have a health assessment that you can download from our website, revitalizemy.church. So there on the homepage, you can download that health assessment. One of the things we did this year, and I was talking about learning from other people and things we want to implement in the new year, is that we had never really done a readiness assessment with the churches, many of the churches that we partnered with.
Yep.
And we started doing that here in the last quarter of the year. We basically hijacked some of the best stuff that we found from other ministries, other organizations that are doing similar work to ours. We're not the only players out there. If you're listening to this and you're part of a Southern Baptist denomination or another group, reach out to your district office. A lot of them will have something that might be able to prepare you for that. Or if you're part of our family, the Charis Fellowship, or, you know, maybe you're unaffiliated altogether and you're looking for some help in that, reach out to us and we can provide you what we have. Would be happy to share that with you, because I think the first step for any leader in terms of leading their church through a significant amount of change is really doing a deep assessment on how ready the people are. And like, for instance, we did one recently with a church and we realized that they were probably not as ready as they thought they were. And so rather than racing to the next point in the process, we've decided to spend a little bit more time nurturing the relationship with them and working them towards being ready for change rather than beginning the change itself. And so lessons that we've learned along the way.
And I think that tool, Bart, that you put together for preparing the church through that prayer study together, it was very helpful in preparing the church for readiness as well. So
yeah,
I think
thanks,
another
Nathan.
Solution.
He's referring to a book I put together several years ago. It's called Praying for Renewal in Our Church. It's a 40-day prayer experience for churches to basically pray through some scriptures and some key points together over a 40-day period, again, in preparation for that season of renewal or revitalization. So I'll link to that in the show notes in case anybody who's listening would like to find access to that. So the first obstacle or the first common reason that we see church revitalization efforts fail is an overestimated readiness. The second is unrealistic expectations about growing younger. We've already kind of joked about that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, we're a church and the average age is 65 plus and we want to reach 20 somethings. But part of the challenge here is that our ministry offerings and our ministry style don't necessarily connect culturally with the young adults or the young families that we're trying to reach. Why don't you speak to that a little bit more?
Yeah, and I think it's a big one. And oftentimes when we're engaging these folks, it's because they lost their grandchildren, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when we're dealing with churches, and you know, my experience has been that the first generation stays, the second generation will stay because they grew up in the church, and the third generation goes because the distance between the cultural expression of the church and the culture they're growing up in is so removed that they leave. And when they exit, boy, those grandparents really feel that loss of not having their grandkids and children in this church anymore. And like, how do we get them back? Which is a great question. Of course, we're interested in getting them back. We're also interested in reaching the community who don't know Jesus yet as well. And they think, well, if we just do this or that, it's going to magically happen. when it's the dissidence between the cultural dissonance between where they are and how they express themselves to the current culture is really far removed. And I usually use this illustration that, you know, when the church peaks, whenever the peak of the church is, that's what the identity of the church becomes, typically, not all the time, but most of the time. So the church peaked in 1995, and that's when it had the heyday and people were getting saved and discipleship was happening and people were growing in their faith. That becomes the identity of the church. So whatever programs, the style, music, whatever, all of that is the same. And the people in the church who came to know Jesus and grew in that season, they think that that's how everybody grows and how everybody comes to know Jesus going forward, because that's how they came to know Christ. And they're not necessarily wrong, because people still can come to the Lord that way. And there's nothing wrong with that method of church or style at all. But the challenge is that it's so culturally removed from that second and third generation. And that's typically what happens is the churches will age out because they're not connecting relative to the people who are growing up in 2020. So when a kid walks into the church, they're like, they're time warping back to 1985 or 95. And they're like, So I usually use this saying where I said to, I tell them, like, the little girl says to grandma, says, grandma says, well, why don't you come to my church? She says, don't you love me? So I love you, grandma. And you love Jesus? I love Jesus. So why don't you love my church? Because if you love Jesus, you love me. You got to love the church. And she's like, no, I don't. I do love Jesus. I do love you. Don't love the church. And they're also looking for a place where they can bring their friends to it, and they want to come to something that's culturally more relevant to them. And so that's a big deal. It's a big change. Now, the problem is that the people still have in their mindset that this is the only way you can do church. They have been doing it for generations. So that's a big challenge, Bart. It's a really, really big challenge.
I think, you know, you sort of stepped on a landmine by using the term culturally relevant for a lot of churches that are struggling, that are aging out. That terminology can feel somewhat unspiritual, that becoming culturally relevant.
Yeah, it also sends up a lot of red flags, because there's a lot of conservative evangelicalism that is anti anything that used the word relevant too. They think it's kind of not godly, and
right.
Certainly I'm no proponent of that, and I'm not opposed to anybody's expression of how they want to do church and reach people or even engage and grow the believers. But I think there has to be a sense that we are trying to engage people who are in a certain culture. You know, if we went to a foreign nation and they have a certain culture, we wouldn't say, no, you need to be our culture in order for us to reach you. No, you adapt. And like Paul says, we become all things to all people, but by his grace, we might reach some. That's what we do. That's the missionary engagement that we need to take to be effective, if not even the expression. I think that's the other piece for me, Bart, is everybody's always focused on the experience on Sunday. And that's the only thing that they think church is. There's a lot more going on in terms of how we reach people, how we engage people, than just what we're doing Sunday morning. And there at least there should be, if we're going to be effective at reaching people. So I think that's a big challenge for people, is that there's a push in the evangelical world to be seeing that as something that's evil. And I guess it can be, we can go too far for sure. But I think we have to be actually looking at how are we connecting with the people who we're trying to reach, that God's called us to reach. And that's something that has to be front of mind for how we're engaging our focus, especially if we're trying to get younger and reaching a younger generation.
Yeah, you use the term cultural dissonance. And I think that I think Jesus is the best example of this. When we read the teachings, the parables that Jesus taught, he used farming illustrations and, you know, illustrations that it would have been easy to understand and grasp by the agrarian culture that he was in of the day. And, you know, if I watch, there's a particular pastor in the UK whose sermons I listen to every once in a while. He uses football, AKA soccer illustrations, because his audience he's in a city that has a huge, you know, soccer team, football team.
Yeah,
I couldn't go to another country and use like American football illustrations the same way that I might here, right? So it's to say that what we're trying to do is remove the cultural dissonance. Not if that's an easier way of saying we want to be culturally relevant. Let's remove the cultural dissonance that causes people to think I just don't fit in here. I think ultimately what people are asking for when they're looking for a new church, a new spiritual community to be a part of, they're asking the question, will I fit in? And when our culture inside our church is geared more towards the 60-something or 70-something person, it's a person who's 25 or 30 is not going to naturally feel like they fit in. So here's my recommendation. I said that we're going to provide a solution. One of the things that we work through with churches is a demographic community study. Who is in the community? And ask the question and answer the question, who are we most likely to reach? Like, you're not necessarily, a lot of churches are like, well, if we just go and hire a young pastor with a young family, we'll naturally start getting young families to come to our church. We know that's not true. We've had churches that we've worked with that have young families in them, but they're the second generation and their church does not attract other young families, even though they have young families in the church, because those families are sticking around out of loyalty and nostalgia, not necessarily so much because there is ministry that is there for them and there for their families. And therefore, it's not attracting other young couples their same age because there isn't ministry that matters to them. It's not done in a way that makes sense to them. So do a demographic study in your church and in your community, then answer the question based on who we are and our oikos as a community, who we're connected with, who we could be connected with, who are we most likely to reach? Because it might not necessarily, yes, growing younger is always, when you're an older church, that's always one of the prerogatives is to try to grow younger. But I would just say, hey, reaching lost people, whether they're the same age or just 5 years younger, let's just go, let's set that as the goal. If we could just reach some, I believe that the Lord would bless us with more opportunity to reach more.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. Yep.
All right, let's go to
focus should be the lost.
Yeah, should be the lost, not necessarily an age group. Okay, third point here. The third point is one of the other common reasons for failure in church revitalization efforts is the speed of the leader. And we have two things that we could talk about here. The most common is the leader who moves too fast, but we could conversely say sometimes the leader moves too slowly.
Yes.
Why don't you talk a little bit, Nathan, about the leader who moves too fast? You've seen this. You have a front row seat for some of these.
Oh, yes. My goodness. Oh, it's the most common problem. And it's completely legitimate because the leader is coming in to bring change. He sees the need and wants to make the change. But what he's got to realize, often doesn't realize, or it feels like the people or the sheep are the problem, and he just starts beating them to move them where he needs them to go instead of leading them for the change that's required for them to be what God wants them to be. And he moves way too quickly because they have to, you know, he's ready. He's already been thinking about this, praying about this on it, and he's coming to make that change, and he's eager to get after it. But the people, they've been living like this for 30, 40, 50 years. And so this ship needs a little bit more vision and encouragement and inspiration. And the leader needs more marbles in his pocket that he can spend before he starts spending them. And so usually he moves way too quickly. He acts more like a manager than a leader in terms of how he's trying to bring change to the church. And those two things, really moving too quickly and then not building the vision and the relational capital to move people, those two things have to be in sync. And if they're not ready because you haven't prepared them and given them the vision to desire it, and you don't have the relational capital to move them, and you're trying to move them anyway, and then you're mad at them because they're not moving, that's a problem. That's a big problem. And lots of leaders have had to, now there's times when a guy's done everything he can to give vision and everything else, and the people just are not going to move. That does happen. But most of the time I would say it's more on the leader's speed in terms of how he's trying to, and strategy in terms of how he's trying to move the congregation.
Yeah, you've used the phrase relational capital a couple of times. And I think this is the one piece that especially visionary leaders can sometimes fail at recognizing, is that you think that because you have a compelling vision that people are naturally going to follow you, but they're going to follow you when they trust you. And so this is in the book, Canoeing the Mountains, by Todd Bolsinger. I've used many, many quotes from this book on this podcast. One of the things that he talks about is the fact that people will trust you off the map when they trust you on the map. This is a reference to Lewis and Clark taking their expedition team off of the map, which was the river route that they were trying to navigate, you know, to the Pacific Ocean, and having to actually go through mountains. And they were off the map. And because the people trusted them on the map, they were willing to trust them off the map. And so I think that what leaders have to do is spend more time leading in the current context, building that relational equity, so that when they do begin to change the playbook and take the church off the map into uncharted territory, someplace they haven't been before, you need people to trust you. And if you haven't demonstrated yourself trustworthy in the context of the way things are, it's going to be very difficult for you to lead in the season of change.
Another good book I think would recommend is The Five Levels of Leaders by Maxwell. He walks you through, and oftentimes we're working on level one, which is just the title, which really is the lowest level of leadership. Right. Just because I hold the title, I'm telling you what to do. That is the lowest level. And so he walks you through the five levels of leadership that give you that ability to really move people. And if you're having a challenge figuring out, man, what are some ways that I can get better as a leader? I think that's a simple read book that would be really helpful for a leader to get his head around. How can I get more skilled at moving people in a direction that God's leading us to?
Yeah, we've already talked about this a little bit, but one of the other things that tends to happen with a leader who's moving too fast is they make changes to minor things that they perceive as being minor, but they cause major uproar.
Yeah, mayhem.
And they also sometimes look at wanting to change things that probably aren't going to matter as much as they think they will. I just had a conversation with one of the guys that I'm coaching just a couple of weeks ago, because he wants to have the conversation about moving from pews to chairs in their meeting space so that it can be more multifunctional. And we've had some churches that have done that. But it's a big deal for some churches to navigate that kind of change. Yeah. And I told him, I said, you're not ready for that conversation. And I know that you would like to do that. And I don't think it's a bad direction, but I think it's premature. Of all the things that you could be focusing your energy on right now,
there are other hills to die on.
Yeah, that is not a battle in this particular season worth engaging in, right? If it's not worth dying for, it's not worth fighting for. And that one's not worth fighting for. So I said, you know, just slow down on that one. Now, yes, the speed of the leader.
One more thing I'd say about that, Bart, too, just to give some guys some more encouragement, too, is find some places where you can win. Because what's going to happen to your levels of leadership is you know, part of it is of course, your authority, your position. The other is the relationships that you have and the character that you possess. But the next level of where you actually get credibility as a leader is when you succeed. And so if you can find small wins that everybody's good with and that you're leading them to win in, that's going to give you much more leadership quotient to lead them in other things that they haven't explored yet or are scared to consider. So just think about that as you're thinking about leading.
Yeah. Now, we're talking primarily here about leaders moving too quickly, because that is definitely the most common problem. But on a rare occasion, we encounter someone who moves too slowly. Talk a little bit about some of the challenges that come when the leader moves too slowly and doesn't enact.
Well, if the church has been properly prepared, that the core people of the church, the key leaders of the church, are eager to move, and they are actually inviting the leader to come to bring the change they're wanting. And they've been part of a process to think about change, and they've been prepared for that. So their expectation is that the leader is actually going to lead them to change. And so when the leader comes and nothing happens for a long, long time, all the momentum that you had from the very beginning, when we walked through the process of agreeing and making a commitment as a church family to wanting a new future, and then bringing the leader in to bring it, to make it happen, it gets really frustrating for those people. And some of your key people who are going to make the most effort to make something happen, they can get exasperated and leave and cause other issues and problems. Now, sometimes they're wanting to move too quickly too. That can be an issue as well. But if you have momentum is a funny thing and it's very, very fragile. And so you need to be able to keep things moving. And if you stop or slow molasses the train. Now, sometimes you need that because there's times when you don't have any relational capital, you don't know anybody that's there, and you need more time to build the trust and build some key leadership teams and build some more vision development. But other times you've done all that and you're just, yeah, you're not leading the church. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you're in big trouble. And the church is in big trouble because it's you're frustrating the people who want to move and you're staying and you're quicksanding the people who already don't want to move. So you're putting yourself in a really difficult spot by doing that.
Yeah. I think, you know, burnout for those that are going to be most likely to help you is, you know, they get burned out waiting. They get discouraged.
Exactly.
They get frustrated. And here's a little litmus test. If you have a very long list of should do's that aren't being implemented, you might be moving too slowly. Look at your list of, well, we should do this and we should do this and we should do this. And if you don't have an action plan for those should do's and you're not implementing those should do's, then you might be moving too slowly. And so here's my solution to the speed of the leader problem in church revitalization. Get a coach. Get a coach who understands change management and who can be a sounding board for you and the brakes guy when you need somebody to help you tap the brakes, or the gas guy when you need somebody to tell you it is time to move. But get a coach. Have somebody that you can run things by who really understands this space. You know, one of the key things that we do in our revitalization revisioning process is we work with a strategic vision team. We want the leader to have a vision team that both helps revision the church, but also bring accountability to the leader to implement the things that we said we were going to implement. So, you know, always, and this is one of the hardest things that we have in a lot of churches, is we look for a person on that vision team who's an administrator. And an administrator is not just the person who writes the stuff down and puts it on the calendar, but we're trying to empower that administrative person with a level of accountability to go, hey, the last time we met, we said we were going to do this, this, and this, and those things didn't get done. So can we agree that before the next time we meet again, we're actually going to get those things done, right? So we need to bring the vision team helps keep things moving, I think, at a pace that is appropriate for where the church is. Those are typically key stakeholders and influencers in the church that are going to help you mobilize other people in the church, but at the same time, gives you some built-in accountability to do the things that you said you were going to do.
And I would also say one more thing, Bart, to this. Sometimes the leader is moving too slow because he's scared of one or two families that are holding everything up. And you know, there's strategies to engage that situation and trying to get them on side and move forward. But, you know, I always say, you know, I don't want to have one or two people determining the future of the church, you know, unless that future is actually reaching more lost people for Jesus, right? So, you know, sometimes, you know, you have to have difficult conversations. And sometimes you're going to have to ask people to step down from positions that are holding things up. You're going to have to do that. And sometimes that leader isn't willing to have those conversations or doesn't feel like he has enough marbles yet in his pocket to do that. And so, like, having a good coach will help you think that thing through and make good decisions, but not letting one or two people in the church control the church. And that sometimes we can do that because we're scared of losing them. And the future of the church shouldn't be limited by one or two people.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, number four.
Although it usually is.
Okay. Number four on our list of common mistakes or common reasons that a church revitalization gets derailed is a complex decision-making process or a complicated decision-making process. It's just, there's too much red tape in order to get stuff done. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Almost every church, well, not everyone, but a big chunk of the churches that we have come into have what's called a church council. Now, the church has been falling, has been shrinking for years and years and years and years, and basically all the people left in the church are the church council. That's pretty much it. And there's nothing wrong with having a church council. It's wonderful that they have a church council. They have some kind of method for organizing the church. It's not what I would choose, but it's okay. But what happens is you've got a church of 25 people, you've got 10 people on the council. And even to have a meeting to get them all in the room at the same time, because, you know, we want to make sure we heard from this person, that person, you know, when everybody gets a chance to share and everybody gets, it's so cumbersome and it's so clunky. And then you have some people who are really spiritually mature and some people who are really immature, people who are really committed to the church and people who don't even show up every but fifth week or sixth week, and yet they have the same say. So it's just crazy sometimes who is making decisions and how decisions are made. And it's cumbersome and awkward and clunky. So yes, clarifying and streamlining how you make decisions and making sure there's accountability and proper process in terms of how things are done is really, really important and really helpful for everybody. When people know how decisions are made and who to go to, it helps everybody on the team to move forward with you better.
Yeah, we're going to do some additional podcast episodes this year on church governance and team structures. I think it'll really be practical and helpful for churches. You know, smaller established churches tend to have consensus thinking, meaning everyone yes. gets a say about everything. And, you know, I brought this up.
And sometimes it has to be, everybody has to agree too,
right.
which really gives the
right.
power to one or two people.
Exactly. And it can be anything from the color of the paint or the drapes on the windows to, you know, the curriculum that we're using in the children's ministry, if we even yeah. have a children's ministry. There's a lot of consensus thinking. And while I do think that there are times and places in the context of a church where a congregational decision should be come to with some level of unity and that the congregation yeah. should be consulted, the congregation can't be consulted on every little thing. It creates so much red tape and it prevents any progress from the leader being able to make any progress.
And it gives power to the least common denominators. And I just yeah. think that that's yeah. not helpful.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, our solution to this would be, it would might be helpful for your church to bring in a third party who can help you assess your current decision-making process. And what we would typically do is we would say, hey, there are staff decisions, and then there are board decisions, and then there are congregational decisions. And those things need to be delineated so that there's appropriate accountability at all level. You don't want the staff to be able to make all the decisions without having board input, but not every decision that the board makes should probably have to be voted on by the congregation. And so being able to discern which pieces of the puzzle fit on which plates, you know, and who's responsible for what. Don't try to rewrite your constitution and bylaws to make this work. That's an error and another battle that you're going to be fighting. Eventually,
yeah, typically
you may have
I
to
ask
do
churches
that.
To suspend their constitution and bylaws to yeah. operate under a simple structure, and they can change it later once they start living in it.
Yeah. I always, you know, I always use the analogy that, you know, was the constitution written for the church or the church written for the constitution, right? Because a lot of times the constitution, a lot of times churches just took a boilerplate constitution and set of bylaws from another church and they just plopped them down and changed their church name and address. Sometimes yeah. they've been rewritten and modified because of a critical issue or an incident that happened in the church. And so we've swung the pendulum the complete opposite direction to make sure that, quote unquote, that never happens again. And then what we end up doing is handcuffing ourselves with the ability to actually be able to make the change that we need to make in order to reach the people that God's calling us to reach. So ultimately, you know, having a third party come in and help you assess is going to probably be the best strategy in evaluating that. And you know what? It's going to take a lot of humility because there are going to be some people on that board or on that council who have always had a say about everything. And the big change is going to be them saying, you're not going to have a say on every little thing. You're going to have a say on some things, but not all yeah. things. And that's going to be the hard part there. Okay, our fifth and final common reason that church revitalizations get derailed is that the church is unprepared to manage internal conflict. You know, this one has been on my mind a lot lately.
Oh, yeah.
The church,
tough one.
Elders, the board, the pastor, they're unprepared to manage internal conflict because here's the deal. Anytime you're leading a church into a new season where you're trying to implement any kind of change, where the church is learning to, if they've called a new pastor, learning to live with and love that new pastor and vice versa, there's going to be conflict. There are going to be issues of conflict. And your ability to navigate that conflict is oftentimes going to determine whether or not your revitalization is successful. You want to speak to that?
Oh, man, there's so many levels of this, Bart. And it's so starting from the leader, the pastor himself, I tell a pastor when he takes a church, you know, he's like, I don't want to have conflict. Well, you're bringing change to the church. So you're already got conflict, whether you like it or not, and you're managing conflict. And conflict itself, I think often people think, oh, we hear the word conflict is such a pejorative word. It sounds so negative, and it doesn't have to be. Conflict just means that we have a difference of opinion, and there's something that we're having conflict on. How do we resolve it so we can get on the other side and be more unified heading out the other side? Much better to have clarity that there is a problem than people pretend there isn't one. Mm-hmm. And I always say unresolved conflict always creates more conflict, always. So as a leader, we need to be observant of where the conflict is in being proactive, engaging that conflict. So that it doesn't fester, it doesn't get long-sighted, it doesn't undermine everything, doesn't change. Because what typically happens, I would say 80% of most conflicts are communication issues. People misunderstood what was going to take place. They assumed a motive or assumed something or whatever. And that's, I would say 80-85% of most conflicts are that. And if you just were proactive and engaging and having a conversation and trying to clarify what was taking place and hear from both sides, you probably would resolve 85% of most conflicts. But other conflicts are real. Like the people have different opinions and they have a different position and they have something that's affecting them, or maybe they don't like the person. Like there's real things that take place. But then there's levels of conflict. So there's a conflict between, you know, one person in the congregation and the pastor. Well, that's a challenge. And so how does the pastor navigate that conflict? Well, my recommendation is that he addresses the person. If he doesn't get clarifying resolution, it seems like it's going to get more explosive. And he goes with two elders to speak with the person. Never go by yourself, and never as an elder, go with one elder. Always bring two elders with you when you are dealing with a problem, because you don't know what the person's going to say that you said and didn't say, and he's, you know, all of that stuff. So resolve conflicts. Try to engage it. You know, Matthew 18 gives us clarity on how we're supposed to do this. But as a leader, I want to try to engage it initially. If that doesn't work, then I want to make sure I have witnesses and godly people helping me resolve this conflict so it doesn't become something bigger. Another challenge is sometimes it's the leaders, the elders, and the pastor, or the pastor and the elders. And that becomes really challenging to know how to navigate that conflict, because who does the pastor talk to if he doesn't agree or is having a real problem with his elders? And who do the elders talk to if they have a problem with the pastor? It's a really big challenge. Now, that's why I think a lot of people have poo-poo denominationalism or being part of a group, but I think that's a benefit of being part of a group, because now you have a higher group that you can go to, a district or other elders or leaders, that you can defer to and say, hey, we need some help here, guys. Come help us look at what's taking place and help us mediate this conflict. And I would say, you know, the sooner you can get things mediated, the quicker you can get it done, the better. And if there's any, like, conflict needs to be nipped in the bud as soon as possible. And good leaders see conflict, they manage conflict, and they deal with conflict. And if you're not doing that, you're going to really have a difficult, messy situation, and you don't have to.
Yeah. I'm going to take things from a slightly different angle here, because what I really perceive, Nathan, especially related to some of the church conflicts that we've had the opportunity to walk alongside churches to get through, is that the churches, everything that you've said is sort of reactive, and I would prefer churches being more proactive in terms of learning how to address conflict in a biblical way when it arises. I don't think that most pastors and elder teams are prepared for that. I read a book this past year in 2025. I think it was called Becoming a Future Ready Church. There was a statistic in it, and it was like a chart, and it gave the top 10 reasons for conflict in church. Number 10 on the list, which is the one that most pastors and elders are prepared for. Number 10, the bottom, the one that caused the least problem, theological differences. Okay. That's right. The one that we're all prepared to deal with, the theological differences.
Yes.
Number one on the list by a long shot was people's behavior. People's behavior was the primary cause of conflict in the church. And I think that that is the area where pastors and church leaders tend to be least equipped to manage. You end up with conflict because people become too confrontational over things that might be changing. Or things you talked about, communication, not addressing things in a thorough and healthy or timely way. What often happens in churches is we let gossip proliferate. We don't know how to address it. We don't know how to nip it in the bud. Or, and I've seen this, we just want to sweep things under the rug. Pretend that it's not an issue, pretend that it's not a problem, and just let bygones be bygones. And we don't ever get resolution to what the problem was, which now that conflict just becomes a cancer in the church. So
totally.
Before, when I was writing this stuff down, I was like, I wonder if I can find some resources online. I couldn't believe a couple of Google searches and I found dozens of online courses and training and consultation groups that help pastors train them in biblical conflict management, elder training in biblical content management, discipleship content that churches and organizations have created for their own congregations to learn how to deal with conflict, both in their own personal lives and relationships, as well as in the context of the church. So my solution to the problem is be proactive. You may not think you need to prepare yourself. It's like pre-marriage counseling. No couple believes that they need the pre-marriage counseling because they love each other.
They're in love.
And everything's going to be perfect. Everything's going to be wonderful. But the best pre-marriage counseling prepares the couple for the fights they're going to have one of these days, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And what you as a pastor, as a church leader, as an elder can do is you can prepare yourself and prepare your church for the conflict that is inevitable. Your goal is to reach people. Your goal is to reach sinful people who need a savior. The more sinful people—
Of which you are one.
Of which you are one, right? Exactly. The more sinful people that you have as a part of your church, the more conflict you are likely to experience. And so my advice, my counsel, my solution to this problem is be proactive. Don't wait for the stick of dynamite to blow up before you start preparing for the conflict that you're likely to experience.
And I would say also, like you're saying, being proactive, we need to be talking about the grace of God, the unity of the body, operating in a way that represents Christ in the way that we treat one another. These basic Christian ways that we operate need to be preached and taught so that when we do have conflict, we're dealing with it with grace and kindness, not with, both fists blazing and our mouths going off, hard faster than it needs to be and creating more conflict. And generally, in my experience, a good chunk of the time, there's a bigger conflict that's come from the minor conflict that initiated it. If they would have just nipped it when it started, we would not be in the situation that we're in. But we're human beings. We live in a sinful world and we're all sinners. And we also have different ideas and different visions and different philosophies. So it's difficult in navigating in the church with all those things being true. But we can do it as long as Jesus is the head and we yield to him and to his word and to the leadership he's given to us with grace and love and pursuing the unity of the body and the mission of Christ first.
Absolutely. Well said. And we're going to land the plane there. We have summarized 5 common reasons that church revitalization efforts fail and have provided you some solutions to those problems. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Revitalize My Church podcast. We want to remind you again, if you haven't subscribed or ever you listen to your favorite podcast, please do that. And if you haven't left a rating or review on Spotify or Apple or wherever you listen, please do that as well. It just helps work the algorithm of the interwebs and more people can find this podcast. And we just want to help more churches become healthy. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.